Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 83, but who's counting? It's Friday, October 9th. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Welcome to the People's School of Public Health and the University of Life. Okay, let's start with COVID-19, unfortunately, like usual. Nationally, cases have gone up 36% in less than a month, and the Midwest has been particularly hard hit. This from U.S. News and World Report. U.S. Midwest sees record one-day increase in COVID-19 cases, hospitals strained. The U.S. Midwest has reported the most new cases of COVID-19 in a single day since the pandemic started, straining hospitals, according to a Reuters analysis. The dozen states that make up the region reported a record 16,807 new cases on Thursday, with a seven-day average up 40% since a month ago. Cases are rising the fastest in the upper Midwest, where the weather is the coldest, with Minnesota, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin all reporting record increases in new cases so far in October. Illinois reported its biggest increase on Thursday since May 14th. And it's not just more cases. The percentage of tests coming back positive is rising and tops 20% in Iowa, South Dakota, and Wisconsin. The number of Midwest COVID-19 patients hospitalized also hit a record high on Thursday for the fourth day in a row and now tops 8,000. Nationally, nearly 34,000 coronavirus patients are hospitalized, the highest since September 4th. Okay, well, drilling down on Ohio, Ohio's number of new cases has gone up 45% in less than 2 weeks, and this from WTVG. Coronavirus spike in Northwest Ohio brings governor to Toledo. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine took a surprise swing through Toledo, through Northwest Ohio today to discuss a recent spike in coronavirus cases in the region. The stop was part of a short tour of the western part of the state, which has seen an increase in coronavirus cases over the last few weeks. During the governor's twice-weekly press conference on Thursday, he announced that five of the top 20 counties in the state ranked by spread were from Northwest Ohio. These included Fulton, Putnam, Defiance, Hancock, and Wood counties, all of which have reported a rate of more than 100 cases per 100,000 residents, which is the number the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention lists as high incidence. Statewide, we're going to see the positivity rate go up, said the governor, to open the press conference at Toledo Express Airport. A couple weeks ago, we were down to about 2.5 to 2.6% positivity. Yesterday, I think we were about 3.9. Our number of cases seemed to be averaging about 1,500 a day, and a couple of weeks ago, we were at about 1,000. The rest of the press conference struck a similar urgent tone as the governor attempted to stress the importance of continued vigilance in the ongoing battle against the novel coronavirus. Much of the conversation focused on the more rural counties in Northwest Ohio, where numbers have continued to grow over the past several weeks, even while more urban areas have kept the spread of virus on a relatively even level. Our urban areas are not out of the woods, said the governor, but they're doing better than our rural counties. Governor DeWine said that part of the problem is in these rural counties is a lower overall rate of mask use, as well as a higher number of people coming together for family gatherings, like funerals, weddings, or family cookouts or parties, While the governor made sure to say that citizens are welcome to attend things like funerals or weddings, he stressed that they should do so safely, taking precautions like mask wearing, social distancing, and holding events outside whenever possible. Okay, well, fortunately, while Northwest Ohio, the rural counties have seen a spike in cases, Lucas County has only seen a smaller increase over the last week. Checking in on our nursing homes, we've seen that our number of active cases has actually went down again today, almost down to record lows. It's been at 39 active cases in recent weeks, but the most recent week we were down to 23. Good news for Lucas County. Okay, well, the University of Toledo held similar with 27 new cases identified, 28 from the previous week. One of the scary things that's new on the University of Toledo campus community front, though, is that their surveillance testing over the last week, where they test people randomly that are asymptomatic, they had a 3% positivity rate, the highest they've run into so far. If this were to translate into the community of over 20,000 people on University of Toledo campus, that would be over 600 plus positive people, infected folks running around. That's a lot, folks. Now, we don't know exactly whether that's representative, but if it's anywhere near that, that's pretty scary. Okay, well, the college campuses seem to be having more difficult times than your primary schools, your K through 12 schools. For the Lucas County schools, in the most recent week, we had 3 new infections identified in staff and 8 in students, and this is down from the previous 2 weeks. Okay, well, let's take a little closer look at the rising cases in the Midwest. This from Politico. Midwest keeps reopening as states reel from new virus cases. Coronavirus infections are crowding hospitals across the Midwest ahead of an election that could see the region decide the presidency and control of the Senate. But the wave of new cases hasn't stopped governors and state legislatures from pressing on with reopening plans. Iowa, Michigan, Wisconsin, and other states are loosening restrictions or weighing changes just as they experience new spikes and as colder weather pushes people indoors, a convergence that could deliver a repeat of the summer's deadliest months. We can't seem to learn our lesson, says Ashish Jha, Dean of Brown University School of Public Health. We touch the stove, it's hot. We burn ourselves, but we think if we touch it again, we'll be fine. As Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Indiana, and the Dakotas all report record or near-record numbers of new infections, the region may be a harbinger of what's in store for the rest of the country. And the wave of cases, along with President Donald Trump's brush with the disease, are again putting the pandemic front and center in key swing states, despite the president's effort to declare it all but over and urge Americans to get on with their lives. In Iowa, which is seeing more than 1,000 new cases a day, Republican Governor Kim Reynolds has refused to mandate face coverings, which the White House Coronavirus Task Force recommends. Reynolds instead rolled back rules on quarantining and allowed college bars to reopen despite outbreaks on the state's biggest campuses. In Wisconsin, the Republican-controlled legislature filed a motion on Friday in support of a lawsuit seeking to abolish Democratic Governor Tony Evers' statewide mask order, even as the state sees more than 2,000 new cases a day. Hospitals are reaching capacity, and the percent of people testing positive is more than triple the recommended rate. Their motion came just hours after Trump announced he had tested positive for COVID-19 and canceled 2 rallies planned in the battleground state. That day, Wisconsin senior Senator Ron Johnson attended an Oktoberfest-themed fundraiser Friday night while he was awaiting his test results and later learned he tests positive. In North Dakota, where the number of cases doubled in September and ICU beds are close to capacity, Republican Governor Doug Burgum bowed to public pressure and rescinded an order that required close contacts of infected patients to quarantine. The state's top health officer resigned in protest, the 3rd health officer to quit during the pandemic. As much as people want to deny it, COVID-19 is still very present, Michigan Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer said on Monday. Michigan's Upper Peninsula is in very serious condition right now. We know Wisconsin dropped their guard, and they're a national hotspot. The surge of cases in the Midwest, fueled by Labor Day gatherings and students returning to class and college campuses, has public health experts pleading for new safeguards before an anticipated explosion in the fall and winter. Yet their warnings are going largely unheeded, and not just among red state governors. Nevada, Wyoming, Florida, and Massachusetts also are loosening restrictions to restart their economies and feed fatigued residents' appetite for a return to normal life. Governors in the state say their residents have learned to live with the threat and know how to stay safe, and they warn economies can't survive with too many constraints, especially with prospects dwindling for another congressional bailout package. Nevada Democratic Governor Steve Sisolak announced last week that he is lifting restrictions on youth and adult sports and raising the limit on public gatherings from 50 to 250 people, even as the average number of new daily infections is up roughly 75% in the last 2 weeks, arguing that conventions, conferences, and trade shows are the lifeblood of the state's economy. Elsewhere, Tennessee, which just had its deadliest month of the pandemic, ended all statewide restrictions on businesses and gatherings, even as the state continues to average more than 1,000 new infections per day. In Florida, a must-win for Trump, GOP Governor Ron DeSantis recently removed all restrictions, surprising local officials after repeated struggles to keep control over the virus. Not only did bars and restaurants reopen, but DeSantis threatened to withhold funding from school districts that did not send kids back to the classroom, even as new daily infections reached their highest levels in more than 2 weeks. But the Midwest has seen some of the most heated fights over when and how fast to lift health restrictions. Michigan and Wisconsin's Democratic governors have tried to impose public health precautions, only to have been blocked in court by Republican lawmakers. Last Friday, Michigan Supreme Court struck down Whitmer's pandemic orders as unconstitutional, effectively eliminating rules around masks and social gatherings. The state health department's move to reinstate the orders on Monday teed up more battles in the weeks ahead. GOP lawmakers have also joined lawsuits to strip away public health measures in Wisconsin. The state's top court in May found that Evers overstepped his authority and struck down his emergency orders, a decision that Evers now says is partly responsible for the state's new spike in cases. Cyrus Schapar, a former emergency response leader at the CDC who now leads the outbreak tracker COVID exit strategy, said the officials' moves aren't surprising given the level of frustration and fatigue people feel. "People are tired of staying inside," he said, "and the longer we go on, the more we incur irreversible damage in some sectors. Can a restaurant operating at 25% capacity, for example, be economically viable?" Schapar said that Trump's constant promises that a COVID vaccine will be approved in a matter of weeks and widely distributed by the end of the year, claims his own top health officials don't support, may also be fueling the trend. "It may increase people's risk tolerance if they think a magic bullet is around the corner," he said, stressing that the scientific community believes neither that a vaccine is a magic bullet nor that it is right around the corner. As small outbreaks that began in K-12 schools and on college campuses spread to the general population, infecting older, more vulnerable adults, hospitalizations are reaching their highest level in 3 weeks and steadily increasing, according to the COVID Tracking Project. And with frigid weather just a few weeks away in large parts of the Midwest, public health experts are warning that loosening restrictions could be a disaster. "We're going into the fall with twice the baseline of cases we had going into the summer," warned Brown University's Jha, "and all the advice we've been giving people, like doing everything outdoors, is going to become harder, if not impossible." Well, next up, and North Dakota is a good example of what's going on in the Midwest. This from the New York Times. "The virus surges in North Dakota, filling hospitals and testing attitudes." When Tammy Gimbel called to check in on her 86-year-old father 2 weeks ago, he sounded weak. He was rushed to Sanford Medical Center, North Dakota's hospital, where doctors said he had the coronavirus. But all the hospital beds in Bismarck were full, his relatives were told, and the only options were to send him to a hospital hours away in Fargo or to release him to be monitored by his daughter, who was herself sick with the virus. Ms. Gimbel and her father hunkered down in a 40-foot camping trailer in her backyard to try to recover. He only got worse. "There I sat in my camper, watching my dad shake profusely, have a 102 temperature and an oxygen level of 86, Ms. Gimbel recalled. "I am sicker than I had been the whole time, and I wanted to cry. What was I going to do? Was I going to watch my dad die?" As President Trump returned from the hospital, still telling Americans not to be afraid of COVID-19, the coronavirus has exploded in North Dakota. In the past week, North Dakota reported more new cases per capita than any other state. Hospitalizations for the virus have risen abruptly, forcing healthcare officials in some towns to send people to faraway hospitals, even across state lines to Montana and South Dakota. Officials have huddled with hospital leaders in recent days to contemplate ways to free up more hospital beds, even as they contend with broader turmoil over virus policy in a state that has seen resignations of three state health officers since the pandemic start. The rise in cases and deaths, September was by far the deadliest month for North Dakota since the start of the pandemic, reflects a new phase of the virus in the United States. From Wisconsin to Montana, states in the Midwest and Great Plains, many of which have avoided large outbreaks in earlier months when coastal cities were hard hit, are seeing the brunt. And in rural portions of the state now reeling, medical resources are quickly stretched thin for residents who can live hours from large hospitals. Still, partly because these outbreaks were slow in coming, public health officials say they have struggled to convince the public that the situation is urgent or that limits like mask rules make sense. North Dakota is one of fewer than 20 states with no statewide mask mandate, and many counties have resisted restrictions. But as the state reaches a boiling point, health officials say they hope people now will start to take the virus more seriously. If there's anything that should get our population's attention, it's this: how perilously close we are to the edge, Vern Dosh, who leads contact tracing efforts for North Dakota, said last week. The state's response to the virus since the start of the pandemic has been complicated and tense as new plans and restrictions emerged. Even its public health official has been in tumult, with Dr. Paul Mariani, an infectious disease specialist, resigning last month after just 2 weeks on the job. Around Bismarck, there are a range of responses to the virus, but people are generally left to make their own choices about the potential risks. Some cafes are bursting with maskless patrons and workers. Other businesses have limited their capacities. Around half of the customers at Al's Barbershop near one of the city's hospitals wears a mask, Travis Zenker, the owner, said. All of it should be a personal choice, said Juan Deser, owner of Little Cottage Cafe, a popular diner where workers do not wear masks. If you feel safe, go out and do what you want to do. If you don't feel safe, it's your right to stay home, she said. As cases have risen, some officials have tried to press for county-level mask requirements. I feel like I'm powerless, said Renee Mock, public health director for Bismarck Burleigh Public Health, who said she received insulting and threatening emails and Facebook messages for suggesting that the county set a mandate. Miles from Bismarck, smaller communities have long turned to city hospitals to handle cases they do not have the capacity to manage, but that is shifting. In the past 2 weeks, my ability to send people to Fargo or to Bismarck has been non-existent, Dr. Sarah Newton of Linton Hospital, a facility in Emmons County, told her city council last week. We got to the point where we knew there was no one who would take them, Ms. Gerving said of patients who were sick but not critically ill. So then we started keeping them in our building, and then we started having an outbreak internally. Back in Bismarck, Ms. Gimbel was still reeling from her own experience with the virus and with her father's. Officials at Sanford Medical Center, where her father was first taken, said they could not discuss a particular person's medical case, but they would never turn away a patient with emergency medical needs. Ms. Gimbel's relatives said that after several trips to the hospital, her father was admitted to another hospital in Bismarck, where he stayed for 5 days and has since recovered. What frustrated me is based on everything I've been hearing, at no point was I educated through the governor or anybody that we were this bad, she said. The bottom line is, my dad needed care, and I couldn't give it to him. Okay, well, moving elsewhere in the country, this from the Hill. Why Mississippi's governor revoked a statewide mask mandate. Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves, Republican, last week became the first governor in America to rescind a statewide mask mandate, almost 2 months after imposing it as coronavirus cases rose over the summer. The decision is a risky one, but one Reeves said is justified by data. The number of people being treated in Mississippi hospitals is down to its lowest level since May. The number of daily confirmed cases has fallen to about half the August peak, and he said the state has plenty of hospital beds available to handle the potential fall surge. Several of Reeves' Republican counterparts in states like Florida and Arizona have said they will resist reimposing lockdowns or restrictions on businesses, even if case counts rise. Reeves said no intervention is off the table if the situation deteriorates. More than 100,000 Mississippians have tested positive for the coronavirus, according to state statistics, and just over 3,000 have died. About 121 of every 100,000 Mississippi residents contracted the virus in the past week, a per capita rate that puts the state near the middle of all states. Better than Alabama, but marginally worse than Louisiana, its two Gulf Coast neighbors. And I just like to use this as another example of what I think is the insanity of lifting restrictions just as we're going into flu season in the next month or so. I don't know. I mean, I'm glad that the governor is open to reestablishing this, but it seems that from a social learning point of view, we should also just get in the habit, since we may be having to really reasonably be wearing masks for, you know, a year or more, even after a vaccine. But so it goes. Hopefully we'll learn.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, with President Trump getting infected, that has, of course, reverberated a lot of things. I wanted to talk a little bit about that and some of the lessons that are coming from that. But this quick one from Forbes: Trump is single largest driver of COVID-19 misinformation, Cornell study finds. Misinformation about the coronavirus is a pressing threat to public health. And according to researchers at Cornell University, who analyzed over 38 million articles about the pandemic published in English language media around the world, quote, the President of the United States was the single largest driver of misinformation around COVID, as mentions of Donald Trump comprised 38% of overall misinformation conversation. And of course, one of the issues that have been raised by Trump's healthcare is confidentiality and transparency. So this from The Hill: the confidentiality of Trump's medical information has limits. Dr. Sean Connolly, Trump's White House physician, has refused to disclose key information about President Trump's medical condition. When asked particular questions, he responded, I'm not going to answer that. He cited the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA, as a reason. But HIPAA rules do not apply if the patient chooses to release his or her information to others. Hence, Trump could easily agree to disclose more information about his condition, eliminating HIPAA as a barrier. Today, a patient's right to privacy is an important ethical principle, but must be weighed against other ethical principles as well, such as beneficence, justice, and avoiding harm to others. Crucial limitations on a patient's confidentiality thus exist when there is potential serious harm to others. With Trump's fitness to carry out his office's duties to protect our nation and advance its interests is now in question. COVID-19 causes significant neurological, cognitive, and psychiatric problems with 36% of hospitalized COVID patients in an early study, and 82% in a more recent study developing neurological symptoms of some type. With SARS resulting from a very similar coronavirus, 59% of patients developed psychiatric disorders, and 33% still had symptoms 30 months later. Moreover, for COVID-19, 40% over age 50 report not having returned to their prior state of health after 2 to 3 weeks. Across all ages, 20% report still suffering from confusion. Trump's symptoms thus pose immense political risk to our nation and the world. Those cannot be ignored and can outweigh the single principle of privacy alone. Trump needs to recognize this fact as well and allow his records to be released. The health of our globe is at stake. Okay, next up from Stat News. The lesson from Trump's catching COVID-19. With this virus, there are no magic bullets. What lesson should we learn from the fact that the President of the United States has caught COVID-19? There is one simple one, which the novel coronavirus SARS-CoV-2 keeps teaching us, which seems extremely difficult to learn. There are no magic bullets against COVID-19. No single strategy or technology is going to rescue society from the pandemic. Not masks, not better testing, not a drug, not vaccines. For any of these, it's easy to get caught up in optimism and hope, but the reality is that fighting the coronavirus requires doing many things correctly. That hasn't stopped people, President Trump among them, from grasping for single, easy solutions. In March, Trump tweeted about hydroxychloroquine, given that the antibiotic azithromycin could be, quote, one of the biggest game changers in the history of medicine. They were not. He said the virus would miraculously disappear with warmer weather. Outbreaks have continued. And lately, he's been betting on a vaccine, saying it come before, quote, a very special date, of course, meaning Election Day. The entire pandemic has been about magic bullets, says Ashish Jha, dean of the Brown School of Public Health. But we're not taking down this enemy with a single shot. Instead, everyone has to become an odds maker or a military commander, trying to minimize the chance that the virus will breach their defenses. The strategy of protecting the White House was a clear example. To keep the president safe, everyone who might come in contact with him was given a rapid test for SARS-CoV-2. But, as Stat reported in April, the test was thought by many outside experts to miss some infections. More than that, any test would miss some infections. No test is going to catch every case of SARS-CoV-2 every time. Every test has false negatives. Yet the White House apparently viewed a negative test result as carte blanche to behave as if SARS-CoV-2 didn't exist. At the Rose Garden event announcing the president's Supreme Court pick, attendees hugged, shook hands, and gathered inside as if a negative test result offered complete safety. There were few masks in sight. In contrast, broad public health strategies against the virus that rely on testing, such as proposals from the Rockefeller Foundation or the proposal championed by Harvard professor Michael Minna, in which the country is flooded with cheap, less accurate tests, don't put such faith in a single test. The idea is that testing often and catching cases when you can will reduce the number of times healthy people are exposed to infected ones. Like everything else in the COVID-19, it's an odds game, and debates over any strategy's utility are arguments about those odds. The same is true of masks. Robert Redfield, the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, testified to Congress last month on their benefit. Quote, "These face masks are the most important, powerful public health tools we have," he said. Nobody knows exactly how much protection a mask provides. That's part of why some experts were skeptical of masking early in the pandemic. But evidence from studies of the physics of transmission and disease spread in countries with different policies on masking have now led to near universal agreement that masking is a good idea. They reduce the odds of the virus spreading. But you wouldn't bet on masks without testing, or testing without masks, or either without social distancing. It's not that there is something special about keeping 6 feet apart from people. Some coughs may spread coronavirus further. But if everybody stays 6 feet away, the odds of transmission go down. And then there are vaccines. People are placing hope in the idea that a vaccine will allow us to go back to normal, said C. Michael Gibson, a Harvard cardiologist known for his ability to analyze trial data. I think that's a false hope. It's not that the vaccines in development won't work or that a vaccine won't be a key tool in combating the virus, but we could still end up needing masks sometimes, or at least we won't go back to shaking hands. But a vaccine could be approved if it reduces symptomatic cases of COVID-19 by just half, and whether it reduces transmission of the virus or just keeps people from getting sick is another open question. What's more, all of the vaccines may be unpleasant to take. They can cause fevers, fatigue, and other side effects, and hard to distribute. The Pfizer shot, in particular, needs to be kept at temperatures much colder than an ordinary freezer. A vaccine that didn't slow the spread of the virus but meant fewer people ended up in a hospital would still be useful. And there's every chance some of the vaccines may outperform this bar. But even several great vaccines probably don't turn off the pandemic like a switch. Josh said that he has advised the Biden campaign that if he wins, they will be dealing with the pandemic well into the next presidential term. What's required now to return to a more normal life is the same thing that's been required all along, a series of incremental strategies, pushing testing, requiring masks, developing vaccines and treatments, and clear priorities. For example, do you want to open schools or bars? Driven by an informed public debate about what matters to society. As H.L. Mencken famously said, for every complex problem, there is an answer that is clear, simple, and wrong. What's required here isn't Rambo-style heroics, it's clear strategy, and the kind of courage and patience under fire that soldiers in the American Revolution needed when they were told, don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes. Well, another thing about Trump's infection is most Americans recognize quite quickly that the care he got is not representative of the care that most people get. This from Stat News. COVID is all about privilege. Trump's treatment underscores vast inequalities in access to care. As the symptoms of COVID-19 took hold, President Trump got an infusion of an experimental antibody cocktail and was whisked by helicopter to Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. When his oxygen levels dipped, he was quickly put on a steroid normally given to patients with severe cases of the disease. At every step of the way, the president had a team of expert physicians carefully monitoring his care. That experience is a world away from the stressful waiting game most patients wade through after a positive test. They are told to stay home and monitor their symptoms. If they do become severely ill, there's only a remote chance they will get access to the antibody cocktail, which is developed by Regeneron Pharmaceuticals and is being tested in clinical trials. The company said Monday that the president was among fewer than 10 people who have gotten access to the drug through a compassionate use program. COVID is all about privilege. The more privilege you have, the more you can ignore some of the rules of COVID. Where one person would need to be in the hospital, another person can have the hospital come to them. That's privilege, said Lakshman Swami, an ICU physician at Cambridge Health Alliance in Massachusetts. If the president's privileged treatment is understandable given his prominence, the contrast is no less stark for millions of Americans who have faced down COVID-19 in their homes or local hospitals, where barriers to cutting-edge care do not simply melt at the mere mention of their names or job titles. That's the most heartbreaking thing about the virus, Josh Barocas, an infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center, a safety net hospital that treats a large underserved population. A portion of the people who are severely symptomatic don't have access to health care, and they are the population that is just being decimated by this. In many ways, it's not a disparity that's exclusive to Trump. High-profile individuals, in particular professional athletes, have had frequent access to testing with fast turnaround results. For much of the rest of the population, however, confirming a case of COVID-19 has meant waiting in line for a test and waiting even longer for results. Many patients are worried about losing their jobs because of a positive test, or afraid to go into the hospital because no one else will be available to care for their children if they're admitted, so they stay home and try to ride it out. For ordinary patients, there's no such thing as precautionary hospitalization. Unlike the president, they would not be admitted based on concerns about what could happen if they are not in close proximity to doctors and state-of-the-art equipment. They are only hospitalized if signs of severe infection emerge. That's a pragmatic limitation of the hospitals, which can only care for so many patients at a given time. But it also means that patients can't get life-saving care if their condition rapidly takes a turn for the worse, as was the case with a 53-year-old black patient who recently sought care at a community health center in Ahoskie, North Carolina, a rural community in the northeastern corner of the state. The patient who had high blood pressure and diabetes saw a doctor at the clinic on a recent Tuesday. He had slightly elevated temperature but reported no shortness of breath or other concerning symptoms that would have warranted a trip to the hospital. Still, his caregivers decided to watch him closely. They called again on Tuesday afternoon and spoke to the patient two more times at home on Wednesday. He reported feeling a little tired but still no shortness of breath, the clearest signal to seek hospital care. We told him if he felt any different at any time to call us immediately, said Kim Schwartz, chief executive of the Roanoke-Chowan Community Health Center. That afternoon he had a heart attack and died. He had a 100.4 temperature and nothing else. I could give you six or seven more cases like that I know personally. Data collected on COVID-19 cases have turned up significant disparities in who is infected and who dies from an infection. State data analyzed by the nonprofit Kaiser Family Foundation revealed that the death rate is more than twice as high for Black patients and nearly twice as high among patients identified as Native American or Alaskan Natives. The data also shows that people with lower incomes are much more likely to become seriously ill. About 35% of patients with household incomes under $15,000 become seriously ill, compared to just 16% of patients with incomes over $50,000. You have this pandemic where you literally see the numbers and faces in front of you that shows that the disease impacts people differently, depending on what they look like and what jobs they work, said Allison Bateman House, an assistant professor of medical ethics at New York University Grossman School of Medicine. Certainly, much of the president's treatment protocol mirrors COVID-19 care in the wider population. Hospitalized patients are closely monitored for signs of deterioration, such as a drop in oxygen level, and many are now able to get access to the antiviral drug remdesivir, which was also used in Trump's treatment. But ordinary patients don't necessarily get the everything but the kitchen sink care received by the president. In addition to remdesivir and the antibody cocktail, the president's physicians also said he was given the steroid dexamethasone after a temporary drop in his oxygen levels. It is unclear whether the president was actually sicker than his doctors had portrayed at that point, but for most patients, the steroid is only given if they are severely ill and already on a ventilator or otherwise receiving supplemental oxygen. And getting access to Regeneron's experimental drug, a cocktail of two monoclonal antibodies, which has yet to have been authorized by the FDA, is harder still. The only two ways to get it are through enrolling in a clinical trial, for which the individual would have to meet specific criteria, or applying for access through a compassionate use program. In that case, a doctor must apply for access based on a patient's immediately life-threatening condition, a process that can typically take a week or more when a patient isn't the president. Because it's not yet authorized, hospital pharmacies do not stock the therapy. So even in the rare circumstance that the drug company approves its use outside a clinical trial, it still takes 1 or 2 days to get it to the patient. If you think you have a patient that's going to need the antibody cocktail, by the time the process is complete, it's possible that you've missed your window, said Barakos, the infectious disease doctor at Boston Medical Center, and that's likely why only 10 people have gotten it the way the president did. Bateman House said the bigger problem is that the process itself is not based on need. We know who gets access to investigational medicine is not a random cross-section of the American population, she said, adding that many patients do not even know there was a way to apply. This particular case of Trump just makes it real for people.
And now a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you, your friends and loved ones, your city, state, your entire nation, suffer from an unprecedented crisis? Then your body politic may be infected with TLTL 2020 virus, also known as the TL20 squared virus. This too little too late 2020 virus has many vague and contradicting symptoms, but it is known to be exacerbated by election years. Do you suffer from exponential anxiety, worldwide depression, and recurring hallucinations of unimpeachable leadership? Don't worry, as the 2020 campaign season heats up, this will all go away. We don't call it a novelty virus for nothing. Hey people, don't look down. Things are looking up. Body bag futures are looking fantastic. This promises to be the best pandemic ever. Incredible things will happen as you save the world by doing nothing but watching TV. But remember, only get your Nothing Burgers from the drive-thru window. Please note, Nothing Burgers will now be referred to as Patriot Burgers. Doing too little has never been easier. Hey, what's the worst? That could happen. This message is brought to you by Cassandra Reproductions, seer of unbelievable futures, and maker of Pickled Posterity, coming too little, too late, to a shuttered store near you. You may now return to your regular programming.
Okay, well, we're going to stick to the theme of inequalities. Next up from Stat News, inequality surrounds you. A Black doctor returns to hard-hit Louisiana after treating and contracting COVID-19 in New York. When the tumultuous history of 2020 is written, no one will argue that Joseph Galleon didn't have a front row seat. In March, Galyon was finishing his residency in emergency medicine in Manhattan just as the novel coronavirus was overwhelming New York City. At 31, he was making life-or-death situations while confronting a disease for which there was no treatment, no cure, and little knowledge. In April, Galyon came down with a cough and a fever and knew instantly that he contracted the virus. When his temperature spiked a week later and he was having trouble breathing, he was admitted to one of the two hospitals where he worked, Columbia University, New York Presbyterian. He developed pneumonia, was showing signs of organ failure, and lost 13 pounds. He was released 5 days later, only to learn that one of his attending physicians, apparently crushed by the weight of the pandemic, had taken her own life. In early June, justice protests over racial injustice were roiling the country. He checked into his first shift as an emergency medicine physician at Lake Charles Memorial, a hospital in his Louisiana hometown, where half the residents are black people, like him. Months later, Hurricane Laura ripped through, destroying homes and businesses and leaving hundreds of thousands without power, including most wings of the hospital. As Galyon looks back on this year of death, destruction, and his own severe illness, what strikes him most are the stark racial inequalities of a healthcare system in which black Americans are more likely to die at early ages of all causes, including COVID-19, a system in which the number of black physicians remains dismayingly small. All summer, Galyon treated hundreds of COVID patients as the virus overtook his state, hyper aware of the enormous gap between where he works now and the state-of-the-art hospitals where he trained. In Lake Charles, he has far fewer resources, from PPE to the equipment he needs to help severely ill COVID patients breathe. In New York, he used small, portable laryngoscopes that were easy to maneuver, but they were too costly for his current hospital, so Galyon uses an older, bulkier device. Such inequalities are the main reason he became a doctor in the first place. That persistent disparity is always on my mind, Galyon told Stat. It just surrounds you. Making his rounds in the hospital, he is constantly reminded of the obstacles he had to overcome to make it this far, an uphill climb reflected in somber statistics. While black people make up 13% of the U.S. population, he is among the nation's 5% of black doctors, a number that has not budged since the late 1970s, according to a 2015 report. The number of black male applicants to medical schools has also remained largely stagnant. In 1978, 1,410 black men applied to medical school. In 2019, that figure was 1,554. Galyon, who goes by Joe, the Cajun Creole spelling for Joe, has always shown up for work in fresh scrubs, diamond studs in each of his four ear piercings, and a pair of sneakers from his wide collection. "That whole white cone thing just isn't me," he said. By now, he knows to expect a range of strong reactions from the minute he introduces himself to patients. Occasionally, female patients might ask to see a woman doctor. Some demand to know his age. But what always, always confounds people are the initials MD behind his name. African Americans are delightedly taken aback. Almost every day I hear, "Wait, you're young, you're black, and you're my doctor?" By contrast, for many white patients, he said, his role as their physician is perplexing. "I always say to everyone, my name is Dr. Galyon, and I'll be taking care of you today. But often with white people, I'll be doing a physical exam, discussing their care, and what needs to happen next, and they'll say, 'Are you taking me to get my CAT scan now?' Or turn to the white nurse in the room and address her as if she's the physician. Sometimes people will ask, 'Can you get me a sandwich?'" He always pauses patiently and says, "I'm your doctor. That's why I've been examining you and talking to you about your treatment plan. Is there a problem?" Usually they demur, he said, or make an embarrassed apology. Just this week, a white scribe had to correct a white patient when she addressed her and not Galyon as a physician. "Legit, I had been standing there talking to her for 5 minutes," he said. "When the scribe said, 'He's your doctor, I'm just your scribe,' she just got this look on her face and said, 'I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry.'" Sometimes, he said, it weighs heavy. "Still, he tries not to take the confusion personally or let ill will creep into my job. He hopes that maybe when white people have an emotional reaction to how I dress, the color of my skin, they will have a different opinion the next time they have a minority physician. He has thought about whether his clothing choices play a role. 'Am I wrong for not playing the part of what an older patient thinks a physician should look like? Is this why I'm being second-guessed? On the other hand, sometimes I treat children, or they'll be with their parents in the room. They'll look up at me up and down and see my shoes and then my ID, my stethoscope, and I think, maybe I'm giving this child an idea for what they can become. Ultimately, he said, I choose to stay true to myself. The distrust of African Americans for the medical community has deep, well-documented historical roots, from the infamous Tuskegee experiments in which black patients were told they would be treated for syphilis but weren't, to the forced sterilizations of black women. But experts say one reason for the continued discomfort is the stunning lack of black people who become doctors. Cato Lorenzen, an engineer, physician, and scientist at the University of Connecticut, who has researched a shortage of black doctors extensively, said his studies confirm that the dearth of black physicians hampers efforts to address the disparities and improve access to care for all underserved populations. We know that black physicians provide more culturally competent care, which translates to better care, he said. One study found, for example, that African-American men with black doctors agreed to more invasive preventive services, such as diabetes and cholesterol screening and a flu shot, than those with non-black doctors. This is not simply a black male crisis, Lorenzen said. It's an American crisis. The scarcity is so striking. Former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg announced last month that he is donating $100 million to four historically black medical schools to support some 800 medical students. While that news is welcome, black children should be encouraged to pursue science from the moment they enter school, said Hilda Hutchinson, senior associate dean at the Office of Diversity and Multicultural Affairs at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, where she is also professor of obstetrics and gynecology. We're not preparing young African-American students to apply to medical school, and that kind of tracking starts in elementary school, Hutchinson told STAT. From an early age, African-American boys and girls are more likely to be reprimanded, to be sent to the principal's office, to have the police called for behavior issues, and to not be encouraged to perform well. There is a tendency for teachers to make assumptions about the ability of African-American kids, especially African-American boys. Gallion said he experienced this discrimination firsthand. It just happens, he said. A lot of individuals don't want to see you grow to realize your potential. They make judgments based on how you look. As a young single parent, his mother, Jennifer DeRusso, tried to instill him with confidence. She considers him a miracle baby, she said, since she did not know she was pregnant with him until she gave birth at 18. Joe was a gifted student who also excelled at basketball, baseball, and football. But DeRusso, a physical therapy assistant in Lake Charles, which is home to several large petrochemical plants and casinos, did not allow him to play sports unless he kept his grades up. As a promising high school student, he took part in an enrichment program offered by a local university, which helped foster his love of science. But his most powerful influence was his beloved grandfather, who had been blinded at his job at a chemical plant. When DeRusso was at work, Gallion and his younger brother went to his house, and the two generations looked out for each other. The boys often accompanied him to doctor's appointments. I was my grandfather's eyes, in a sense, Gallion recalled. The experience of helping his grandfather navigate the medical care system made a lasting impression. He started talking about becoming a doctor even before he was in school, DeRusso said. We'd be eating dinner and Joe would say, when I grow up, I'm going to find a way to fix grandpa's eyes. Diagnosed with cancer when Gallion was in high school, his grandfather left him a lasting wish. Before you die, he told me, Joe, don't become a bum. Study, make something of yourself. Be a role model for those coming up after you. Touch somebody. Still, when he was a teenager, teachers and advisors discouraged his larger aspiration of being the first person in his family to finish college. A lot of times I'd get the whole spiel. You're smart and all, but you should just think about going to trade school so you could just work at the plant. Those remarks just made him more determined. I used their comments to add fuel to the fire, Gallion said. I'd listen and smile and say, thank you, I've got bigger plans in mind. I didn't grow up seeing black doctors, and I didn't grow up seeing college-educated individuals, but I knew I wanted to jump, hoping that when I did, I'd jump to bigger things rather than face planting. In 2007, he received full-ride scholarships from universities across the country, including the University of Texas at Austin and Rice. But the cost for extras, as well as homesickness for his family, friends, and his favorite Louisiana foods, seemed prohibitive. As a devout Roman Catholic, he chose to attend New Orleans Xavier University, the nation's only historically black college that is Catholic. But there were challenges. In medical school at Louisiana State University Health Sciences Center, New Orleans, he was the only black male student in his class. In part because he knew he might be the first black doctor many of his patients saw, and in part due to its flexibility and range of conditions he might be treating, Gallion decided to go into emergency medicine. He knew what he wanted, and he was relentless in pursuing me as a mentor, said Lisa Moreno Walton, a professor of clinical emergency medicine at LSU. Each year, Moreno Walton gets 150 requests from students who would like her to be their advisor. I have to choose wisely, she told Stat. I have two criteria, identifying people who are willing to work hard and who will give back to the community. I could see Joe would do that. Indeed, he became the National Conference Chairman of the Student National Medical Association and was co-president of its local chapter. Yet as he applied for elite residencies in the Northeast, he heard again, "Your resume isn't good enough for the Ivy League." It was hard, he said, not to think people were not judging him by his skin color. During his daily prayers, he asked for strength. "You're going to do this," he told himself. On match day in 2016, he learned he was accepted to Columbia University, Irving Medical Center, and Weill Cornell Medical Center. While Galleon loved his time in New York, there was never any doubt that he would turn to the South to be closer to his family and friends, as well as Etouffee and Jambalaya. "Here, I also feel I have the opportunity to be more influential to those around me and to be available to them. There are not a lot of people in the ER who look like me," he said. "I can provide my community with someone they can relate to." Still, back home in Louisiana, the past few months have been trying. Many of his colleagues lost their homes in a hurricane, but still came to work, sleeping at the hospital, where only the ER was functioning. "It was very depressing, but at the hospital, our job is to stabilize patients and to stay strong," he said. "You've got to stay focused." In between shifts, Galleon spends time with his family. He's raising money for hurricane relief, helping college students with their applications to medical school, and mentoring 10 medical students. 7 of them are Black. "Other people before me did so much more with less," Galleon said. "I've got to keep paying it forward." Okay, well, I'd like to close out the show switching gears a bit and talking about climate change. This first one from Inside Climate News. Battered, flooded, and submerged, many Superfund sites are dangerously threatened by climate change. The Government Accountability Office, GAO, warned in a report last year that 945 Superfund sites across the United States are vulnerable to hurricanes, flooding, sea level rise, increased precipitation, or wildfires, all of which are intensifying as the planet warms. Far from a theoretical future threat, the Superfund sites are a clear and present danger. But the Trump administration no longer makes reference to climate change in addressing these risks at Superfund sites, Inside Climate News, the Texas Observer, and NBC News found in an investigation of the Superfund programs and the EPA's response to climate-related threats. Reporters interviewed more than 50 experts outside and inside the government, reviewed thousands of pages of EPA records, and analyzed federal data on Superfund sites to determine the extent of the danger to human health and the environment and the missed opportunities to mitigate it. Among the findings, more than 700 of the 945 sites vulnerable to climate change are in 100-year floodplains, meaning they have a chance of 1% or more flooding in any given year, and over 80 regularly flood at high tide or are already permanently submerged. 49 of the sites face triple threats. They are in 100-year floodplains, regularly flood, and are vulnerable to hurricanes, according to EPA and GAO data. 74 sites threatened by climate change nationwide contain toxic waste that remains uncontrolled and could damage human health, according to the EPA's own risk assessment. The Trump administration has largely abandoned plans written by all 10 EPA regional offices that factored climate change risks into Superfund planning and remediation, former officials say. The plans were written in response to a 2012 Obama administration directive. The following year, President Barack Obama issued an executive order that made climate change preparedness a national priority. President Donald Trump rescinded the order in March 2017. The GAO found that the EPA's current 5-year strategic plan makes no reference to climate-related risk in relation to Superfund site management, planning, or cleanups. Rather than cleaning up toxic waste at Superfund sites, the EPA began in the 1990s to cap the sites with soil, clay, or even concrete, a less expensive method that leaves the chemicals in place. Experts and former EPA officials argue that practice has left those sites increasingly vulnerable to hurricanes, sea level rise, flooding, and wildfires. At the San Jacinto waste pits, a concrete cap that was installed in 2011 after a previous hurricane didn't stop the site from flooding and leaching chemicals during Hurricane Harvey, the EPA's own inspectors found. In all, more than 250 two Superfund sites nationwide flooded in hurricanes Harvey, Maria, and Irma in 2017, according to EPA data. The EPA reported leaks of toxic waste at the U.S. Oil Superfund site outside Houston, as well as at the San Jacinto waste pits. Environmentalists have questioned whether the inspections and cleanups at other sites were sufficient. At numerous other Superfund sites across the country, EPA officials have approved caps, often thin layers of clay, earth, or sand, to contain highly toxic waste. And at site after site, environmental activists and attorneys have argued that intensifying hurricanes, storm surges, and flooding make those caps inadequate. They often favor actual removal of the waste, which is far more costly. EPA's common practice of consolidating waste and leaving it in place in landfills or under engineered caps may no longer be protective of human health and the environment if climate change results in frequent massive flooding of the Gulf Coast areas, the 2014 Superfund report by the EPA's Region 6 office says. Okay, and the last story I want to end with some good news, and this is also related to climate change. This from Stat News. Doctors offer guide for teaching the health effects of climate change in medical residency. As massive wildfires, hurricanes, and record-breaking temperatures hit parts of the U.S., a group of doctors is urging medical residency programs to implement standardized curricula on the health impacts of climate change. The framework, published in a paper in Academic Medicine, includes a breakdown of high-risk populations, including the elderly and low-income families, and a review of the current understanding of how climate impacts health, such as the relationship between air quality and respiratory illness. The framework also encourages consideration of the health impacts of displacement due to extreme weather events. Those who lose their home due to a hurricane, for instance, often develop post-traumatic stress disorder or face other mental health challenges. They are also at a higher risk for developing other conditions such as food insecurity that could in turn affect their physical and mental health. We wanted to link the content of what residents are supposed to learn anyway, said Rebecca Phillips-Born, a pediatrician at the Emory University School of Medicine and lead author of the new paper. Physicians have been sounding the alarm on the health effects of climate change for years and the need to train future physicians how to treat patients accordingly. In 2017, the American Medical Association and more than 25 other health organizations created the Medical Society Consortium on Climate and Health, which called climate change one of the most important issues of our time. And earlier this year, a group of medical students from more than 50 U.S. medical schools founded Medical Students for a Sustainable Future, an organization working to recognize climate change as an urgent threat to health and social justice. The AMA passed a resolution last year that supported including climate change in medical training curricula at the undergraduate, graduate, and postgraduate levels. While there have been some efforts to offer climate change and health as an elective course at medical schools, the authors of the new paper argue that there still isn't a standardized way that climate change is incorporated into medical training. Well, hopefully their initiative works out well. That does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. Or you can queue up future shows, re-listen to this show or past shows. Go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.